Support for WKAR is provided by Douglas J. with two Lansing area salon locations, the Okama Salon and Spa and the East Lansing Salon inside the East Lansing Marriott, now offering gift cards for Valentine's Day. DouglasJ.com. And by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet. Insured by NCUA.
It's Current State. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore here on WKAR. It's Thursday, and we're glad you're with us. What should Michigan's priorities be regarding energy? Should electricity rates be more competitive? What's the future of natural gas exploration and consumption in the state? Should utilities be required to produce more electricity from renewables? Well, these and many other important issues are being stirred up this afternoon here in Lansing at the Library of Michigan. This public forum is a chance for citizens and groups to raise issues and ask important questions relating to energy. This is the first of seven Michigan Energy Public Forums being held around the state, and Governor Snyder will use the results of these meetings when he makes his comprehensive recommendations regarding the state's energy future. That is scheduled for December. John Quackenbush oversees these public meetings in his role as head of the Michigan Public Service Commission, and the MPSC's main role, or the role it's probably best known for, is approving or denying rate requests from the state's utilities. Joining Mr. Quackenbush, Wayne Kuipers, Executive Director of Energy Choice Now. This is a Michigan group pushing for more electric competition, free markets, and lower rates. And Hugh McDermott of the Michigan Environmental Council. Thanks to all of you for joining us here on Current State.
Good morning.
Good
morning,
to see
Mark.
You. John Quackenbush, what topics do you expect to hear from participants later this afternoon at the Lansing Public Forum regarding energy?
Primarily three topics. One is renewables, which you mentioned. The second one is energy efficiency. And the third one is electric choice. Those are the big three topics that we have. The way we handle those now was set in 2008 legislation, and we're trying to gather information useful on all three of those topics and perhaps others for the legislature to potentially make some revisions in the future.
In a sentence or two, let's go just a little bit deeper on each one of those three areas. Renewables. What do you expect to hear regarding renewables from the public?
Michigan is on track to reach the current standard of 10% by 2015. We expect there to be interest by some parties in increasing that, setting a higher standard for a future year. There may be some opponents that would be opposed to that. I think we'll hear from all sides of that.
Okay. Energy efficiency?
Energy efficiency. We're on track to, we have energy efficiency targets of 1% a year starting in 2012. We've built up to that. It's 1% on electricity and 0.75% on gas. We've been achieving that. We've been exceeding those targets. So one of the questions is, should we increase the targets, set a higher standard? And we have a whole host of questions we're asking people to answer about that, which are posted on our website, michigan.gov/energy.
And that's 1% less electrical consumption per year?
Yes.
Is that what I... Okay, very good. And electricity rates?
Electric choice. This is where we have a 10% cap on customers who would like to choose an alternative electric provider for their generated electricity versus their incumbent utility. Currently, our two big utilities in the state, Consumers Energy and DTE Electric, have reached the cap. There are no more customers that can select or that they can get in a queue. There is a waiting list for customers to get into the competitive electric market and get their electricity from an alternative energy supplier.
So you expect renewables, energy efficiency, and electrical rates all to be a part of the governor's final comprehensive recommendations in December. All of those will be addressed in that document. I think, is that baked in the cake already?
Well, those are the big three that the governor highlighted in his special message on energy and the environment right at the end of November last year. And so he does anticipate to look at all the facts and data and studies that we gather and make recommendations.
Okay. Wayne Kuipers, I know more competitive electricity prices is your group's big concern. Prices, I think we're in agreement, prices have climbed dramatically in recent years. Why is that?
Well, again, we have the highest prices in the Midwest and some of the highest prices in the country when it comes to electric energy. In 2008, the cap rate number was set at 10%. At the time, we were experiencing about 3% choice in electric competition. I sat on the Energy Committee at the time. And
What does that mean, 3% choice?
3% of those who could choose to buy their electric energy from an alternative energy supplier were doing it.
Okay.
Okay, so we had about 3% competition in Michigan in 2008.
So you either live in a Detroit Edison area or you live in a consumer's area, and then that's done. You got no alternative.
Right.
There. Okay.
Right. Okay. So right now we are at the 10% cap. We reached that number rather quickly. Within about 12 months, we were at the cap in both service territories. We now have over 10,000 companies in the queue. Waiting to take advantage of choice if choice is offered. In fact, if we were to snap our fingers and eliminate the 10% requirement in the law today, we would be at about 25% choice across the state of Michigan. So there's clearly demand. We've seen the membership in our association grow from 100 or so members to over 1,200 members. And those members are businesses, large and small, individuals, trade associations, all those who are really struggling with the increases in rates over the last 4 or 5 years.
Okay. Hugh McDermott, does Senator Kuipers have a point here? I mean, was the renewable energy standard responsible or tied to the rise in electricity rates?
Our focus isn't on choice as much as it is on increasing our efficiency and renewable targets. But we think that the recent increases in electric rates have more to do with the increasing price of some of the fossil fuels, especially coal. The cost of coal delivered to Michigan has gone up 71% since 2006, and we think that's a big driver in costs. Roughly 60% of Michigan's electricity is generated from coal, and we have moved based on the 2008 law to a lot more renewable energy, and we think that along with the efficiency program especially is working really well in exerting downward pressure on rates. Renewables are now competitive with the fossil fuels, even with natural gas at its low prices, and efficiency, according to the Public Service Commission, is a really good deal for ratepayers. For every $1 invested in efficiency, $3.55 is returned in the form of saved energy. So we're really looking to push the case for renewable energy and energy efficiency increases.
Well, if Prop 3 had passed, would you say that electricity rates would not have gone higher? This would have called for this was the 25 by 25 proposition.
Correct.
which was defeated.
Mm-hmm.
Would you maintain that had it passed, electricity rates would not have gone dramatically higher?
I would say that with Proposal 3, if we did an aggressive renewable energy standard, I think that would help keep electricity rates in check. I would not go as far as to say that it's going to keep them from rising. There are a lot of other factors at play.
In the
cost that you pay for your electricity. But renewable energy is definitely lower than new coal right now in terms of cost and will help exert downward pressure on rates.
Wayne Kuipers, why don't you respond
to that? What we've seen nationally is about a 50% reduction in the cost of energy. That's largely because of the introduction of natural gas and the findings of the shale. Our position is not that it's the alternative or the renewable energies that are creating the bump up in price in Michigan. Our argument is it's the lack of competition. Okay, if you inject competition back into the system, you will see rate you will see pressure on rates drop.
Okay.
So, you know, our position is the companies that we represent that want to supply alternative energy into Michigan, some of the big companies like Direct and First and Constellation Exelon, they all have to play by the same rules as the Michigan-based companies do when it comes to having a 10% mix of renewable energy in their portfolio. Okay, so we don't see that as the reason, the sole reason why rates have increased in Michigan. Our position is rates have increased mostly because we've eliminated competition.
Hugh McDermott, what do you make of Senator Kuiper's group and its priorities mm-hmm. here and this lack of competition?
Like I said, we don't have a big dog in that fight, so we're focusing on renewable energy and efficiency right now. Michigan Environmental Council does intervene in rate cases at the Public Service Commission on behalf of residential ratepayers to protect their interest and keep their rates from rising. So we do have a concern that if we move too fast and too aggressively in deregulating and allowing more customer choice. If we do that too quickly, we're going to leave the customers who are left with the utilities, who primarily would be residential customers, with a lot of the fixed costs that are involved in the infrastructure and everything. And that may be harmful for them in terms of making their rates go up. So we do want to keep an eye on that. But again, our chief focus is not on customer choice. Our chief focus is on the efficiency and the renewables.
John Quackenbush, how much does converting to renewables add in terms of costs to consumers, the Lansing Board of Water and Light, other utilities?
Well, that's a great question. That's exactly some of the facts we're trying to ascertain in our public forums and the written comments we're asking people to submit. We have at the Commission certain data that shows what the cost of renewable generation is, and it's been very favorably downwardly moving in the last several years. But we're asking people to make comparisons for us of what they know the latest data are on all kinds of renewables energy, not just wind, but biomass and solar and the like.
Wayne Kuipers, how does your group get what it wants here? I mean, you want more competition. What's the linchpin there? How do you get there?
Well, we advocate for our position. I think we formed as an organization in 2010. I think what we saw our mission being initially is raising awareness both among the citizens of Michigan but also among the elected officials in Michigan. So, we've had meetings with the governor and his staff, with the Public Service Commission. We've had numerous meetings with legislators trying to raise awareness of the issue. You know, I give this administration a lot of credit. They were singularly focused the first 2 years on improving Michigan's business climate. They changed the business tax, in many cases lowered business tax rates. They've been very aggressive in changing the regulations across the state, all in an attempt to lower the cost of doing business in Michigan. This is one of the top three drivers. If you talk to business people, they will cite taxes, they will cite the ability to attract qualified workforce, and then energy. Energy is always at or near the top in a list when companies are asked, what do you look for either when you're looking to expand in Michigan or to move to Michigan? So this is really the next big issue for Michigan. We have to get our arms around an energy policy that results in lower rates to provide relief both for residents and for business. You know, one of the fastest growing market segments in choice in Illinois is in the residential. They have created a strategy where they're now marketing to residences saying, you know, we can lower your rates by 10, 20, 30%.
Comment real quickly. We're down to about a minute and a half here. We see rising prices in coal, dramatically declining prices in natural gas. Do I have that right? That makes for a very interesting pricing dynamic in terms of electricity. John, care to comment on how that plays out?
Absolutely. I think we are seeing proposals around the state for new gas generation plants being built. I think that's part of the reasons, because gas is a lot cheaper as a commodity than it used to be.
Okay. A final word here, Hugh McDermott.
Yeah, very interesting. Price of gas is very competitive right now. It's subject to fluctuation. We still like renewable energy because that's a fixed cost. Once you build the wind turbines or the solar panels, the energy is free, and we're looking forward to the forums and helping helping make that case.
That public forum is this afternoon, 1 to 5, at the State Library of Michigan here in Lansing. It's the first of seven. Hugh McDermott of the Michigan Environmental Council, Wayne Kuipers, Executive Director of Energy Choice Now, and John Quackenbush of the Michigan Public Service Commission. Thanks to all of you from Current State.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Welcome back to Current State on WKAR. Mike Worf is known to countless Michigan and Midwestern radio listeners as the longtime host of WJR's Kaleidoscope. Kaleidoscope brought listeners an hour-long journey into people, places, and events woven together with period music, archival news recordings, and Worf's distinctive narrative. Kaleidoscope often showcased uniquely American topics. This was particularly so during America's 1976 bicentennial celebration. To mark the occasion, Mike Worf chose to produce a series of programs devoted to composers of the great American songbook of the early to mid-20th century. Through a friendship with famed songwriter Gerald Marks, Worf was able to conduct dozens of in-person recorded interviews in New York and Los Angeles with the likes of Johnny Mercer, Harold Arlen, Sammy Kahn, and many more. The interviews were incorporated into Kaleidoscope as a weekly showcase of the composers and their music. Recently, the interviews have returned as the subject of two books authored by Mike Worf, American Popular Song Composers and American Popular Song Lyricists, an oral history, 1920s to 1960s, published by McFarland Incorporated. WKAR's Peter Worf visited with his dad earlier this week to talk about how the Kaleidoscope radio project of the mid-70s led to the books of today.
I had done the programs in 1975, 1976.
Kaleidoscope.
Kaleidoscope, yeah. And they were all part, one of these music shows went on once a week. I did about 900 interviews, but I only did about 65 shows because I got tired of doing it. I mean, you know, enough is enough. let's get on to something else. So I took these tapes that I had and I brought them home and I put them away. And for 30 years, I'd forgotten all about them. Hadn't given it a thought. Every once in a while, someone would say, oh, I remember that series you did on the composers, but other than that, I hadn't thought about it at all. About five Christmases ago, I was in the basement looking for Christmas ornaments, and I came across this box of material. I said, my goodness, look at these. And it'd been years since I'd even heard them, never mind finding them.
These were dozens, maybe 100 or so of reel-to-reel tapes.
Yeah. Well, cassettes too, but reel to reel too, yeah. So I said, oh, just for the fun of it, I'll listen to a few of them. And I did. And I said, gee, this stuff is good. This is really good. Other than the fact that I did it, I don't mean that. But this is good stuff. They're listening to these wonderful composers talk about the anecdotes and the stories and the flavor of Tin Pan Alley and Broadway as it was, So I said, I think I'm going to try to write a book. Use this in written material to put a book together. It's got to be of interest. So that's precisely what I did. And it wound up being published by McFarlane out of Carolina. And they saw it as do one book on lyricists and one book on composers, because that is the difference. It made it a little more difficult because you lose the importance of each one to the other, how important the lyricist. There's a wonderful story by Mrs. Hammerstein, Oscar Hammerstein's wife. They were at a cocktail party. And there's always a discussion, which came first, the music or the lyrics? You always hear that question being asked. So Mrs. Hammerstein was talking, and she happened to overhear a conversation that was going on 15 feet from her. And in that conversation, the woman was saying, oh, have you heard the latest song by Jerome Kern? Wonderful song he wrote called Old Man River. This was 1927.
Showboat.
Yeah. So This is Hammerstein walks over. She says, I beg your pardon. She says, I just heard what you had to say about Jerome Kern writing Old Man River. Oh, yes, wasn't it? She said, I'm sorry. Jerome Kern did not write Old Man River. My husband, Oscar Hammerstein, wrote Old Man River. He wrote the lyric. He wrote the story. And that's the, you know, that you hear in song. There's an old scream on the Mississippi. Yeah, that whole thing. And she said, Kern wrote the melody, which, like the river, carried the lyric. But my husband wrote the song.
We're presenting this program about your books about American popular song composers and lyricists on Valentine's Day. Uh-huh. So let's have, I asked you to prepare this. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Dad.
Yeah. Right.
Let's go through your list of some of the greatest songs of love and romance for Valentine's Day. I know that's about half of the output of these composers.
It's a heck of a challenge. It really is. Yeah. I mean, to think of all the great ballads of love songs. Yeah. We have the marvelous ability to express our love to whomever, in not only in the spoken word, but then in a song. You know, you just take Oscar Hammerstein and Richard Rodgers. Just think of the love song. People will say we're in love, from Oklahoma.
Don't praise my charm too much. Don't look so vain with me. Stand in the rain with me. People will say we're in love.
If I Loved You from Carousel. I don't know what the Sound of Music, but there had to be a song in there about.
Yeah, sometime in my youth or child, I must have done something good.
You know it better than I, yeah. But when you talk about love songs and Valentine's Day, it is indeed very difficult. But there are songs that do come to mind when I think about it. It takes a song like Witchcraft.
It's witchcraft. And I've got no defense for it. The heat is too intense for it. What good would common sense for it do?
It's a wonderful lyric. Then there's At Last, which was Etta, what was her name?
Etta James.
Etta James, yeah. And she did such a, because it was a pretty song that Glenn Miller did, but when she took that over, she was able to emote that, you know, that lyric.
At last.
The Way You Look Tonight. I mean, lovely, just The Way You Look Tonight. You know, great song. Laura. Now, that's a specific song for a specific movie. To
a murder mystery.
Yes, to an individual character.
That was Laura, but she's only a dream.
So, it doesn't befit to sing that song to Mary. Or Helen, it's Laura, but listen to that lyric and what Mercer does to that and how he can just get the essence of what this love is, you know. I think music takes a look at what's inside the human being, you know. You could say soul, I don't know about that, you know, however you want to phrase it. But I think it's a side of man that really is a gentler part of his nature, which can be gentle, you know, and beautiful.
Mike Worf is known to many Michigan listeners and beyond as the longtime host of WJR's Kaleidoscope. He's the author of two recent books, American Popular Song Composers and American Popular Song Lyricists, Oral Histories, 1920s to 1960s, published by McFarland and Company. Thanks, Dad.
Thank you, Pete. It's been a joy.
For Current State, this is Peter Worf.
It's such an ancient pitch, but one that I'd never switch. 'cause there's no nicer witch than you.
It's Current State on WKAR. You can reach us via email at currentstate@wkar.org. Bullying isn't just happening in school hallways or on the playground anymore. In the cyber age, online aggression has surged. Two recent reports by MSU professors focus on the world of cyberbullying. One study was led by Thomas Holt, assistant professor at MSU's School of Criminal Justice. It found, amazingly, that cyberbullying is just as impactful as physical bullying. Salim Alabash, assistant professor in MSU's Department of Advertising, also collected research on cyberbullying. His work explores the use of social networking sites to fight the phenomenon. And we welcome both Thomas Holt and Salim Alabash to WKAR's Current State. Welcome.
Hello. Good morning.
Tom, are you there?
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
You both come from very different fields of study. Tom, you're a criminal in the criminal justice department, while Salim, you work in public relations and social media. I'm curious as to what drew you both to research cyberbullying. Salim, you first.
Well, I think this is a very important issue, and the way that I'm intrigued by the topic is how to find solutions for this problem and how to use existing social networks in order to promote anti-cyberbullying behavior among different age groups. So I'm approaching it from more of a persuasion perspective rather than defining what the problem is, which might be different than what Tom's approach is.
Tom Holt, what about you?
As a criminologist, I'm interested in trying to understand the behavioral and...
Nope. Sounds like we lost Tom Holt. Salim, it's you and me.
Yeah.
Hopefully we'll get Tom Holt back on the phone here in just a second. For those of us of a certain age, I only read about cyberbullying. The internet, Facebook, Twitter, all of it has been such a recent development in my life, my younger years. The internet was a twinkle in some. It wasn't even a twinkle in somebody's eye. It was completely unimagined. Mm-hmm. How does cyberbullying for people like me who have never really witnessed it firsthand? How does cyberbullying manifest itself? What kind of things get said?
Well, I think the basis for cyberbullying is very similar to traditional physical bullying, whether it's physical or verbal, but it is expressed online using electronic devices. So it's any form of aggression that someone perpetrates against someone, another person, using any type of information technology, be it the internet, posting on someone's Facebook, posting on someone's website, sending them nasty text messages. And the interesting thing is that we're seeing a lot of that happening. There's a lot of attention being placed on cyberbullying among teenagers and, children, but not a lot is being discussed about other forms of bullying that extend to life after school, which means, college-age populations, different age groups. And the difference between cyberbullying and traditional bullying is mostly bullying happens in a confined time and space. It happens at school for a total of, let's say, 8 hours, whereas cyberbullying can happen at any time with no restrictions, and whatever is posted online might stay there forever.
Mm-hmm. Tom Holt, in your work, you looked at data from middle and high school age students in Singapore, and you were looking at the impact of cyberbullying versus the impact of physical bullying. Tell us what you found.
Yes, we found that for students who were skipping school as a consequence of bullying, the physical bullying experience and cyber bullying as well as mobile phone bullying all were a significant correlate of skipping school. For kids who were thinking about committing suicide as a consequence of their bullying experiences. Again, everything physical or cyber was significant, but we also found that for some youth, spending time either instant messaging for girls or being bullied via mobile phone was a significant predictor for males. So there are some gender differences depending on the outcome that we're looking at.
Does any significant percentage of young people who are online, do they tend to use the internet or their cell phones less once they've become a victim of cyberbullying? Did that come out? That just crosses my mind. Salim?
That wasn't covered in our study, but we are interested in this issue. Generally, there's some evidence to suggest that youth who are cyberbullied might not report the experience because they're afraid that they might lose time on the computer or lose access to their mobile phone in an attempt to reduce the likelihood of repeated victimization.
See, and the reason I bring that up is if kids are not going to school once they've been abused online, it would only make sense that they might not go online quite as often as well.
Yeah, but the thing is that everything that is put out online stays there. I mean, we've recently known about cases like Amanda Todd, who was cyberbullied online, and she did change schools because of the physical and verbal bullying that she has had at school. But all the stories, all the negative comments followed her to her new school. So I don't think that moving away from the internet or not using the technology will limit the effects. Instead, we're trying to promote good citizenry online and how can people be respectful online.
One other issue that comes up also is that some youth who are cyberbullied might in fact engage in bullying behavior themselves online mm-hmm. as a response. So it could be that that might actually exacerbate time online, depending on the individual.
Yeah.
Tom, continue. How do we address this? What's the most effective way to address this?
It's a significant challenge. It doesn't seem as though there's one single answer to this problem. There's a benefit in thinking about how school policy can be addressed and extended in such a way as to not be too restrictive, but also how do we incorporate parents into school solutions, given that if their child is bullied at school and this continues when they're at home, how do we find a way to make parents more cognizant of the ways that their kids are using technology? How do we create a dialogue between parents, teachers, school administrators, and the kids? Even if nothing else, if we are able to increase the number of kids who report when they're bullied online, that might help to bring some light to the problem itself.
And Salim, you've concluded that a more positive spin on anti-bullying is more effective than a more negative spin.
Certainly. I mean, the study that we have done have mainly addressed the issue of where do we put out messages on cyberbullying that promote anti-cyberbullying behaviors. And we created a mock campaign for a fictitious nonprofit organization. And we did find that positive messages were much more effective than negative messages. Even though the issue is pretty negative, so you know the challenge becomes how do you make something positive about something that is so negative. But we did find that people responded better to positive messages.
Salim Alabash is assistant professor in MSU's Department of Advertising who collected research on cyberbullying, and Thomas Holt led another study. He's an assistant professor at MSU's School of Criminal Justice. We thank both of you for joining us on Current State.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
And it's now time for another public poetry announcement with Current State producer Joe Lindstroth and Stephanie Glazier, the acting director of MSU's Center for Poetry.
The Forgotten Dialect of the Heart by Jack Gilbert. How astonishing it is that language can almost mean, and frightening that it does not quite. Love, we say. God, we say. Rome and Machico, we write, and the words get it all wrong. We say bread, and it means according to which nation. French has no word for home, and we have no word for strict pleasure. A people in northern India is dying out because their ancient tongue has no word for endearment. I dream of lost vocabularies that might express some of what we no longer can. Maybe the Etruscan texts would finally explain why the couples on their tombs are smiling. And maybe not. When the thousands of mysterious Sumerian tablets were translated, they seemed to be business records. But what of their poems or psalms? My joy is the same as 12 Ethiopian goats standing silent in the morning light. O Lord, thou art slabs of salt and ingots of copper, as grand as ripe barley lithe under the wind's labor. Her breasts are 6 white oxen loaded with bolts of long fibered Egyptian cotton. My love is 100 pitchers of honey. Shiploads of thuya are what my body wants to say to your body. Giraffes are this desire in the dark. Perhaps the spiral Minoan script is not language, but a map. What we feel most has no name, but amber, archers, cinnamon, horses, and birds.
That was The Forgotten Dialect of the Heart by Jack Gilbert. A lot of specific detail in this poem.
Absolutely.
Ingots of copper, slabs of salt. He gets even more specific with time periods and places: Etruscan texts, Rome, Minoan scripts, Egyptian cotton.
Ostensibly, he's giving us a little tour around the world of different kinds of beauty. If you know something about Jack Gilbert, you know that he lived in Greece for a little while. He's lived in fabulous places, the most beautiful places in the world. So this is also, while it's absolutely a universal poem, it's kind of a history for him of the things that have affected him most as meaning and beautiful.
For you, Stephanie, what questions does this poem pose?
For me, this poem asks about the power of language, and it kind of tests the limits of what it can do and what it can't. I think what Jack Gilbert is doing here is asserting beauty as meaning. So he's not saying, you know, this long-fibered Egyptian cotton was beautiful. He's calling them breasts. He's saying that Sumerian tablets could actually be the most meaningful thing, you know, that we'll never have access to. It's a fabulously imaginative poem, but it's so rooted in concrete things that we actually see all the time. Honey, we see honey all the time. And he's saying to us, these things can be meaning in our lives if we allow them to. The Forgotten Dialect of the Heart is the title of this poem. It's forgotten, right? It's a way that we can live and speak with each other, right? In this kind of meaning, dwelling in this kind of beauty. But we forgot it. He's also saying in this title that it's a dialect of the heart, which is to say it's as natural and innate to us as our own heartbeat is. We've let ourselves forget, and I think he's trying to remind us.
And what speaks to me is the limitation of language.
Absolutely.
And to create these metaphors that are so direct, mm-hmm. basically saying love equals pitchers of honey.
Yeah. My love is.
It is. It's equating the two.
Yeah.
And that's what it is for him.
Absolutely.
That's how he would describe it, within the limitations of language.
Absolutely. He's saying, look what I can do, right, with this tool that is language that I have. And also he's calling attention to what we can't do with language, right? People in India are dying out because they have no word for endearment. And then we end the poem, we leave the poem with what we feel most has no name, but amber, archers, cinnamon, horses, and birds. He's saying, don't try to describe things.
Forget
experience
angry,
them.
Frustration.
Yeah.
Happiness, all of those, but instead experience life.
Yeah.
And what that might equate to, those
right.
feelings.
Right.
You know, I've always been personally fascinated with the limits of language as someone who travels, and there was a novel that was really influential to me mm-hmm. back in college, William Faulkner's As I Lay Dying. And being the bit of a geek that I am, I wrote down a quote from the book, and I folded it up and kept it in my wallet for probably about 8 or 9 years.
That's
actually.
So great. What is it?
He had a word, too. Love, he called it. But I had been used to words for a long time. I knew that that word was like the others, just a shape to fill a lack. That when the right time came, you wouldn't need a word for that any more than for pride or fear. William Faulkner. I think he's getting at a lot of the same things that Jack Gilbert is getting at here.
Absolutely. What is ineffable? What can't we tell each other? And what can we? And what Jack Gilbert is saying is, let's see. Let's try.
Let's try. And I think in the context that Faulkner is saying is this limitation causes misunderstanding and discomfort and all the other things in life, disconnection. And language is supposed to bridge that gap, but when language itself is the problem, is the limitation, sure. Then what are you left with? Perhaps a beautiful poem.
Well said.
I'm Joe Lindstroth, the producer of Current State, with another public poetry announcement brought to you by the Center for Poetry at Michigan State University's Residential College in Arts and Humanities. Thank you, Stephanie Glazier, for sharing Jack Gilbert's beautiful poem with us today.
You're more than welcome.
What is this thing called love? This funny thing called love. Just who can solve its mystery?
You're listening to Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. More than 400 Michigan farmers had a chance to meet with their state legislators this week to talk about their priorities for 2013. The Michigan Farm Bureau has outlined three main focus areas for its agenda: access to markets, workforce development, and regulatory reform. Current State's Kevin Lavery sat down recently with Jennifer Lewis and Michael DeRider. Both are members of the Michigan Farm Bureau's Board of Directors. DeRider says access to markets largely means having good roads and bridges, a cause for which Governor Rick Snyder is urging the legislature to spend more than $1 billion.
Well, some of the numbers that I was given is roughly 80% of our roads are in fair to poor condition. I mean, this is a critical issue in getting agricultural products to market, not just on a finished side, but on a raw side as well. I can give you a specific example. We also have a small food processing facility that we do tart cherries. There's a road right next door to us that's getting massive potholes, bumps. The road's in extremely poor condition. We have to reroute the route that we take down to a cold storage. That's just one of the prime examples of this. I mean, and this isn't just an agricultural issue as well. I mean, when you improve the roads, it's not just agriculture that gets a benefit from this. It's all aspects in every industry.
Who is our export market?
Canada is our biggest export market. I believe there's a third of our products here in Michigan go to Canada. Very surprising for some. Even though we're so close, no one really realized that Canada is a huge export market for us. So bridges, roads, the infrastructure that we have is definitely needed to get our products over there in a more timely fashion.
I'm going to switch now to workforce development. And Michael, you said you represent the young farmers. I don't have it in front of me, but I've heard before that the average age of the U.S. farmer is somewhere along 55 or 60. It's not a young population. What is being done in this state to encourage a younger workforce?
Right. Well, one of the things that we're pushing for at Michigan Farm Bureau is the Michigan Merit Curriculum. There's a lag right now between a person who gets a high school education and a person who gets a four-year degree. Not everybody is geared up to get a four-year degree. Within agriculture, we're looking for people that get these technical degrees, such as a two-year degree. I have a brother-in-law, for example, who's a welder. Very useful employee on the farm, as you can imagine, with implements and whatnot. We need to allow high schools to develop curriculum programs that better suit the need for agriculture, because as we go forward, there's going to be a big gap in the workforce that we need to accommodate. So we're looking for a little better program for those students that might not be geared up for a four-year degree and might be more adequate for a two-year degree.
What about our migrant labor force? We rely upon many people, primarily from Mexico, for our fruit harvest. The federal government is taking up immigration reform once again with some renewed efforts. Recently, Secretary of State Johnson approved driver's licenses for the DACA-eligible immigrants, people who came to this country before they were 16, so that harkens back to infrastructure again. Thoughts on the progress that we're seeing in Washington and how that could ripple back to Michigan?
Well, the immigration issue definitely hits home with me, particularly with fruit. I mean, we hire a lot of seasonal employees. You know, as Michigan Farm Bureau, we're definitely pushing for immigration reform. We need seasonal workers. We've been seeing a decline, particularly in Oceania. We had asparagus and some crops that went unharvested due to a lack of labor. So it's a very important issue. Some of the priorities that we would like to see going forward will be a program that allows us to have a usable workforce that we can implement. Right now, we're working towards that. We're working with legislators. We'd like to see some action on this, not on a state level, of course, but on a national level. As Michigan Farm Bureau, we would like to see this not come into a state issue, as some states are doing down south.
Jennifer, you look as though you're ready to pounce in with an answer here.
No, I totally agree with Michael. It needs to be a national program, not a state program, because of the variety of products that are grown here in the state. There are many seasonal migrant labor that come into the state. I have a dairy farm. We also rely on immigration labor, immigrant labor, but they stay here. They're not in 1 month and out a couple months later. So it's very important to the majority of Michigan agriculture that we have a solid workforce, people that are ready and willing to work, and unfortunately, sometimes we find that we don't have a very willing workforce of Michiganders. And so it is important to all of agriculture that we obtain, that we keep, and hire good workers.
I'm going to stick with a federal issue. The federal farm bill is still hanging fire out there. It passed the Senate. It's still not gone through the House yet. I'm sure Debbie Stabenow is chomping at the bit. Thoughts on getting that through? What can be done to influence our federal lawmakers, and what benefits that may bring to Michigan once it's finally approved?
Well, that's a very good question. Of course, we would like to have had a farm bill already. We feel that that by them putting it on the table really doesn't benefit anyone. It was a very big topic that we spent a lot of time on in Washington, trying to help legislators understand how important it is to agriculture. Like you said, unfortunately, it didn't pass. It's got an extension. We are, of course, working on trying to help those legislators understand that it is an important issue for us, that we do need updating of that program, and that we are very willing to help them figure out how to make that happen. But, you know, we need to keep in mind, and your listeners need to keep in mind, that it's not just about agriculture. Agriculture only impacts a very small portion of that farm bill, and the majority of that farm bill is nutrition programs for the needy, and probably not just the needy, but that is a big part of it. And so other people really should be concerned about the farm bill, not just the farmers.
Michael, I'll ask you about the third leg of the agenda, which is regulatory reform. What regulations need some reform? What's the problem?
You know, when we look at regulatory reform, for example, we're looking at, you know, not necessarily that agriculture is complaining necessarily about regulation, but we're just looking forward. I mean, the governor has put a strategic food initiative out there to try to expand growth throughout our industry. We're trying to come up with that challenge and meet the needs that the governor has put forth before us. In order to meet those needs, we need regulatory reform so that way if a business wants to come in, a processing business wants to come in the state of Michigan, that's relatively quick and easy for them to be able to set up and efficiently run without all the red tape and taking forever to get them here. And if we can get these people here, I mean, that's tax revenue for everybody towards programs.
Final question I'll ask Jennifer. What idea would you want to communicate that you're hoping would resonate and get some action at the state capitol?
You know, our goal is to engage them with our members and to have our members tell them what we're interested in, what bothers us, what keeps us up at night. And so the whole premise of this whole program is to have that contact. and have that one-on-one discussion about Michigan agriculture and the things that we deem important today.
That was Current State's Kevin Lavery speaking with Michigan Farm Bureau board members Jennifer Lewis and Michael DeRider. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll look at a new book called Ink Trails, Michigan's Famous and Forgotten Authors. Join us then. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Joel Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks to Aaron Young for engineering and Sonia Treeweiler for production assistance. Happy Valentine's Day. Mwah! I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by Fluke Hearing, featuring American-made products that provide hearing technology for every lifestyle and life stage, with 8 locations throughout mid-Michigan. FlukeHearing.com.